Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
And we are live with another edition of Pollock and Thurston and the ever-growing intro. I am in the midst, Brandon, of compiling for version two. I was really inspired the other night. I don't know how many people are following Who Killed WCW, but let's just say that we're putting this one away for safekeeping.
I know the numbers. The numbers are on the internet.
Internet, okay? The numbers are on the internet.
Bro, they're on the internet.
I hope people were watching that. That was a video exclusive there from Brandon Thurston. That was great. You really got me there. Well, everybody, we are here. We are not going to be talking too much about WCW. Brandon distilled it perfectly last week with his breakdown. WCW died in March of 1999. The rest was just like a bloodletting. It was flatlining in 99. That was the last moment of life. Is that what you concluded, Brandon?
I concluded that business started to go down and did not return in the other direction. It was just all as far as pay-per-view buys and TV ratings. It was all one way down and never turned back.
Well, I will say that if you go to WrestleNomics, they do have a great breakdown of all of the WCW pay-per-view buys and the astounding figures when you go from 99 to 2000. It's amazing. There are like some 85% like declines year over year if you go from, I believe it's the Super Brawl event from 99 to 2000. We're talking like the 80 percentile like drop. That's like 8 out of 10 viewers that spent money on your product decided a year later, I'm okay. I'm good.
Yeah. What was that? The Finger Poke of Doom happens in January. Uncensored is the March pay-per-view probably, right?
Yes.
Lord knows it was on that. What was Super Bowl in 99? Was that Flair and Hogan? Look at me.
It's Flair and Hogan that they do like a very good number. So this is only a month after the Finger Poke of Doom. They did this great number in February of 99. And I would say like that is the last truly, maybe April of 99, I recall being like the last, what you would call like very good pay-per-view number. And it's just a precipitous drop throughout 1999. And then we're free falling in 2000 and you're seeing the year over year declines that you would have been able to retire off of if you were running WrestleNomics in 2000.
Yeah. I really missed out on some opportunities, including the Monday Night War, the Wednesday Night War. WrestleNomics would be a much richer company if it had existed at those times.
Well, never underestimate the ability of wrestling promoters to shoot themselves in the foot, Brandon. You will get your golden age. It will come. Mm-hmm. Well, today we have two guests coming your way. It's a doubleheader edition here on Pollock and Thurston. We're going to be chatting with our favorite combat sports attorney, Eric McGraken, who's going to make sense of what went down last week inside of a court involving Judge Richard Boulware, who I'm sure is on everyone's Google search list. He had some observations about the recent settlement terms between the UFC and its classes of fighters in the Kung Lee and Cajun Johnson antitrust suits with the UFC. And he had some, quote, serious concerns. So we will talk with Eric about what these serious concerns could mean and what to make of the settlement that, I mean, you could sense the streamers being thrown around at TKO headquarters after the settlement news was made. And wait a minute. Richard Boulware did not get the invite to this party. Also joining us,
he's thinking about making both cases continue. potentially? Is that what we're looking at, or just one of the? Because there's two lawsuits here.
It's both. It's both mm-hmm. that are okay. being ruled upon.
He's concerned about the later year fighters.
It's just a combination overall. His in a nutshell, from my understanding, is that you know he certified this case that the damages could be in the billions, and you guys settled for $335 million. He's stating that the plaintiffs is like, you guys did such a good job of convincing me here that I feel you settled under what the market conditions should dictate for yourselves. And I don't think we'll chat with Eric about this, but I don't sense like the plaintiffs are dying to go into a trial and risk it. I think they want to cash out now and take what is at least guaranteed on the table with this $335 million distributed multiple ways.
Yeah, we'll get to it.
And Lucas Sharpio, he is returning to Pollock and Thurston. He was in Glasgow, Scotland this past weekend for Clash at the Castle. We are going to speak with him about his live coverage at the event and the post-show / press conference. I think a confirmation that we were getting a press conference. In fact, we were concerned
that there might not be one, or there might be a very much edited and controlled one.
Yes, I was assured there would be a press conference. And this post-show amounted to Wade Barrett, like before and after, ranting about CM Punk and I guess just various...
Eviscerating the wrestling media for asking softball questions, I understand.
I'm sure Wade Barrett, he will be there front and center at the next event to ask the real questions to Paul Levesque.
So, as a broadcast journalist, he should try to get credentialed.
Yes, he's gonna have some bad news for Paul Levesque. Did you get to see any of Clash at the Castle?
I had it on. I think I had all of it on, yes.
Okay. Well, he is already getting set to join us. So we're going to bring in our first guest of the day. He did his work for WrestleNomics and Post Wrestling over the weekend. You can check out those articles on both of our outlets. He is back on the show, Lucas Sharpio, the man on the ground in Glasgow. Lucas, how are you today?
I am doing great. Thank you so much for having me, John and Brennan. I appreciate being back at Pollock and Thurston show. And thank you for giving me the chance to work for both of your outlets during the last weekend. I'm glad to be here tonight.
Was this a smoother event to cover than the last one?
Yes, mostly because I didn't twist my ankle during that weekend, so that felt good. Also, you know, being in another country, visiting another country, it was a fun experience to do that outside of France. I enjoyed the show storyline wise, and I had the chance to also do my second experience at a press conference, which went more positively, mostly because I didn't ask a question. I don't think it would have gone smoother had I asked the question that I had in mind. But nonetheless, I was glad to make the trip.
What questions did you have in mind?
So there were a couple of ones. The first one being, is WWE's cooperating with federal investigation, and was a Triple H, Paul Levesque, I should say, question about it. Also, the question about Stephanie McMahon as she returned to an executive role following her on-screen return at WrestleMania, and if not, is that something that can happen down the line? And overall, as I said in my article, so I didn't want to do the same mistake that I did in Backlash in France. Being the last question, I don't think it's a mistake in a proper way, but I feel like my question being the last one at the first press conference definitely I highlighted more the subject than maybe it was the reason why it got brought up so much on social media. So I didn't want to be the last question. So my thought was that I was going to wait the two first questions, then ask mine. And I raised my hand, maybe too shyly. I didn't get called on. And then I was like, let's see how this goes. And if the subject gets brought up to the table, I will ask a follow-up. I had, to be honest, I had still my last experience of the press conference in my mind. And maybe I put too much pressure on myself in that room, or, you know, having thoughts of what are going to people think about my question, me, my work, etc. So maybe that played too much role during the night.
In terms of just the access for all the media members, to your understanding, like, where were you guys set up in the arena, and was everyone granted access to the press conference afterward?
So I think everyone was granted a press conference access at the end of the show. I don't know everyone from the media members, but the most person that I knew from social medias, people that I saw from the media, they were all there. Maybe there were media members that were not granted access, but I don't have that information. So me, I was sitting right behind the ringside, all the ringside seats. Like, I was, I don't know how to say in English, but I was on the first floor behind the ringside seat. And I was not in front of the art cam. Sorry, I was in the other way.
And I guess this event, according
so
to
Paul, I had a good view on the show. Yeah.
This event, according to Paul, according
we
to Paul,
we still have a delay.
Yeah, this event, according to Paul, that broke the gate record. Did you notice anything different about like who attended this event in terms of? Because these tickets were so expensive, was this a different crowd than you would have expected to see otherwise had this been, I don't know, a house show where there were, you know, lower ticket prices?
So I arrived in the arena, so in front of the arena, maybe at 2:30, 3 p.m.
Hey, Lucas, we might just shift you just to audio. I think we're getting a bit of a lag in your video, so let's just go to just audio. Mm-hmm. All right, we're good. We're going to reconnect here with Lucas, and maybe we will just go to audio with Lucas when he gets back. But yes, wanted to definitely get some of his live thoughts on the show, just being actually in the arena as opposed to like a private box, but also the fact that a lot of people, Brandon, were talking about the ticket prices for this event. And when you're going after an arena record, you are pricing out a lot of people, but it doesn't seem to be curbing demand for these tickets, whether they go to France or Scotland, and this is only going to continue. People are kind of looking at, there's a huge segment that are not able to afford these tickets, but it's not harming WWE, and there are people that will spend these extraordinary prices and be setting these records that is only going to increase the scale of their ticket pricing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it is a sticker shock for a lot of people, but I would imagine if you compare WWE's ticket prices to those of entertainment more broadly, you're going to find WWE's ticket prices are among the lowest. And, you know, it's being priced to demand, as you said, and there's been years where WWE could have gone to do the PLEs in international locations, but has not. And that has really built up this pent-up demand for these events, which has allowed them to break these arena records.
Lucas is back with us, and Lucas, can you tell us a bit about the just overall vibe of the environment as you were arriving at the arena and the fans in Scotland, and how this differed from France, which is also a market that was getting a pay-per-view / premium live event for the first time? Was it comparable, the atmospheres of the two?
So, it's very much comparable because they're reaching to a market that is craving for content from them. So of course the fans are going to be excited and loud and wild. So when I arrived at the arena, many fans were in the pop-up shop that was near the arena to get merchandising. I would say that as soon as the countdown show was launched on YouTube, and there was Kathy Kelly who made interviews with the fans
in near the arena, in front of the arena, I should say. Many fans got excited. There were a lot of chants. And in the arena, one thing that I noticed that they introduced during the weekend is the creation of the Decibel Meter, which to me is what made Puerto Rico so special, what made France so special, is the fact that those crowds were naturally invested into the show. They didn't need a decibel meter to get loud. So I was a bit, not disappointed may not be the right term, but I was like, the reactions may not be as natural as they were in Backlash in Puerto Rico or in France. But nonetheless, the crowd were invested, of course. And during the main event, Drew McIntyre got a huge reaction from the arena. That was the main story of the night. The local hero going to be a world champion. So the crowd were very loud during that show. And the big difference between France and Scotland is that after the show, there were loud bullshit chants as Drew McIntyre lost his match. And Scotland fans made sure they made sure that WWE understood that they were pissed off, you know. So they were leaving the arena, and Senator Enver Irvine, said goodbye to the crowd, get home safely, etc. There were very loud bullshit chants that I heard in the arena.
So we made a public records request to Glasgow that I haven't heard back on to try to find out if there's any sort of subsidy or site fee associated with this show. Did you notice, I think what will often be a hint towards that is when you're in the local area, when we were in Detroit for SummerSlam, for example, there were, you know, like entire sides of buildings that had like, you know, Jey Uso and Roman Reigns' face on them. And there were trains that had WWE, W marketing on them, banners hanging from the streetlights and things like that. Did you notice any kind of W marketing around town other than there, as you said, there was the pop-up shop, but was there any other WWE marketing around Glasgow that you saw?
That's a thought that I had during the weekend, because I was surprised to not see a lot of it. To be honest, I saw one shop with the WWE logo on it. I don't think it's an official like pop-up shop, because it doesn't have the current logo of WWE. Like, it's the logo from their Ruthless Aggression era, so like 15 years ago. So that was that shop, and otherwise I didn't see like advertising in the streets or in like bus in some part where they're doing the WWE show. There's a advertisement like on public transport or something like that. I didn't see that. Maybe they were in other parts of Glasgow that I didn't have the chance to visit, but from the places that I went, I didn't see anything, to be honest with you.
Going back to the reaction at the end, I mean, that video was circulating a lot of the fans' dissatisfaction with the end of the main event. Did you sense from the audience that this was, you know, in any ways a risky finish to do for this market, or do you feel that there is certainly a this market, at least, I mean, it's a finish that is not going to detract from future business? But we are getting into this era where these giant ticket prices, I think it's only natural that fan expectation is going to be raised for what they are investing in these big shows, as opposed to being just kind of a middle chapter in a longer story. Did you get any sense of like, what was this at all a negative finish to look at potentially if they come back to Scotland for a show next year, for instance?
I think WWE is so hot at the moment that they're kind of bulletproof with their audience, in my opinion. I think that negative reaction was in that moment. They were angry at their favorite losing the match. But still, with WWE being so hot with their audience since 2 or 3 years ago, I believe they are bulletproof with any markets. The prices, definitely, the price increase could definitely be a step back, especially for low-income families I saw an article made by the BBC who interviewed like two or three families in England that they were basically saying in the article that they couldn't afford to go to WWE anymore and that they couldn't make the trip to Clash at the Castle. So maybe that will change for those low-income range families. Otherwise, I believe that WWE is bulletproof at the moment. There were a little portion of the fans in the arena that were happy to see CM Punk. That should be noted. He got, of course, he was booed, but there were some fans that cheered for him because it was kind of surprising, even though there were rumors of him being spotted in Glasgow. I think he made also in Instagram stories in the city. So, yeah. There were a portion of the fans that were happy to see CM Punk. And I don't think that that will play a huge role with them going back to Scotland in the near future if they decide to.
As we just circle back to the press conference, anything just in terms of differences between the press conference in France versus this, did you find that it was a pretty similar setup in terms of the questions that were asked as well? Was there any discernible differences and just your kind of overall thoughts on the presentation of how it was done this time around with, you did have CM Punk part of this press conference as well, unannounced.
Yes. I think there were two main differences for me. The first one being, there were no French translators, of course. That's an easy take. The French announcer, was also a part of the press conference in Backlash. Obviously, Scotland being an English native, English speaking country, it was not there. So there were no translations. Also, the second difference is, I think, there were more people that I had done previous press conferences, before. I think most of the people, inside that room already made several press conferences, which I don't think was the case in France. Other than that, the people that were interviewed, so Abba Fire and Isla Dawn, it was kind of nice to see their reactions and the emotions. Damien Priest, yeah, I think also the difference is that the wrestlers played a bit with the media members. CM Punk took a shot at one of the reporters asking about the fantasy booking question, CM Punk's words. Damien Priest asking the media members to rise. Which
did you rise, Lucas?
To wait? No, I did not. I had the donuts for CM Punk, even though I was starving. I wish I had one, but I did not. To me, it's a little bit cringy when they do that. But also, it's not mean. It's not I can see that they're doing it to, maybe lift up the mood in the room. I don't know, but we're media members. We should not be part of the show. That's just my thoughts on that.
Yeah. There were moments like that in the WrestleMania press conference. The moment everybody remembers, when Roman Reigns had someone removed right from the room or something.
That's right.
Like that. It's so weird. Did you get a chance to follow up with Paul Levesque on which media outlets are credible?
Was there a list?
No, I did not. Unfortunately, that could have been
lists were exchanged.
Yeah. But there was one representative for Fightful. I don't think there was one for PW Insider. If there is one, I'm sorry, I didn't know. But there was someone representing Fightful in the press conference.
Well, I thought that it was, you know, this was not as much of a newsworthy press conference coming out of it, but it was, I would say the fact that there was no news coming out, you know, some of these companies, their goals are to have no headlines coming out of certain public interview events.
Why do they do them then?
Well, that's a great question. I think this is like, you know, just you feed the content beast, but it doesn't bite back at you. And that's what I think this press conference was. For Paul Levesque, he came out of this, and this was one of his better press conference outings after, because I didn't think people had too much to criticize. Though I will note that after so many of these, like, he really does have this formula down pat, where he comes out and it's like a filibuster at the beginning of this. He's got to go at least 10 minutes. And I think Lucas pointed out in his article, like, it's almost like he just wears you down, and then it's okay, and now we have time for three questions.
Yeah, that was my thoughts, because so someone on Twitter mentioned to me that it was 14 minutes. That felt like 4 hours.
14 minutes.
I thought I was going to, 14 minutes. The monologue before he opened up the question. I thought I was detained against my will. It's just a joke. Please don't insult me on Twitter. I'm just joking. But, it was long. It was long, immature to go down to every matches on the card, every numbers. WWE have trillions of billions of millions. Congratulations to them. And yeah, it was a long, long monologue. But nonetheless, I was still wake up is not the right word. I was still awake. Awake is the right term.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would encourage you to, like, be. There should be no pressure on us to not ask questions if they are legitimate questions and respectful questions. And the sort of, I think what does happen when we're in those rooms is, whether it's intentional or not, I sort of think these things are less intentional, like Paul Levesque going on a long filibuster, we could call it. I think it was a filibuster at Royal Rumble, because there were some serious questions that were very obvious at that time. Okay, he does have a lot of people to thank. But the sort of atmosphere that builds and builds, because you do, as I think we talked about with you, Lucas, when you joined us after Backlash, there's this procession of mostly people who have won, some of whom have won championships, and this is a big moment in their careers, and there's this feeling of elation, you know, for one set, for another set, for another set. And now it does, as you said, Lucas, it feels like a party. And for you to ask a question, it feels like you're changing the tone in the room, and you're changing what seems to be a party. It's not a party. It's a press conference. Yes. And you're talking to one of the major executives of this company who's responsible for everybody who he oversees. And I think it's completely within respectability, within, you know, being respectful at this press conference, and within doing your job to ask him specifically a question about are you cooperating with a federal investigation? That's a major news story right now. And I totally empathize with this feeling of, like, oh my God, what is going to be the response to this? But that's what they benefit from, and that's what has to be dismissed by us and overcome.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And this was clearly what I thought. Like, I didn't want to. And I know this is, in a way, I didn't do my job properly during that press conference, because looking back at it, of course I should have asked my question. But in my mind, I was really thinking, like, I'm going to be that person again. Once again, I'm going to be that person who asked about that subject. And
isn't that sort of a criticism of everybody else in that room, though, that they won't? They've come up with reasons not to, you know?
Yeah, in a way, yes. Although I'm no one to judge anyone's work, but also I like you said, these subjects should definitely be covered. And if they don't want those subjects to be in those press conferences, don't invite reporters. Don't invite. Do those press conferences with plants or with actors. Go take Wade Barrett or take anyone from WWE. But
that would be my follow-up. It's like to the next person that gets that kind of defensive posture from Paul Levesque, my follow-up would be, what are we engaging in here? Like, what is this? You call it a press conference. Is it supposed to be that? Am I not wanted here? If these are not the questions you want, then why am I invited here? And you're opening up the forum to take any and all questions. Like, that would be my question. Like, let's all, it's part of where I find it, like, it's somewhat aggravating when you see the all rise moments at these press conferences. But at the same time, I give some leeway to these performers who I bet they don't know what these are supposed to be. They are just finishing a performance and they're ushered in where this is technically a WWE production. I'm playing Damian Priest and these are just the other characters in another WWE production, but they're,
and everyone's applauding when people enter the room.
They applaud. They're setting the tone themselves. Absolutely. So I understand why wrestlers don't even necessarily know. It's great when you get a Bryan Danielson, but I also understand why a Toni Storm is going to be in character or some of these other characters, because it leans more towards an extension of the show than it does to a traditional press conference. And I do sympathize, Lucas, with like what you were through and the idea that I'm sure a lot of people can just state, well, just like you're a guy that had to I don't want to like regurgitate all that you had to go through after Backlash France, but I can understand anyone that gets all of that vitriol of just not wanting to go through all that again. And that's certainly an indictment of how people online respond to these and the scrutiny that people in that room find themselves under. That's a lot easier to just avoid rather than engage, and suddenly you're the main character on wrestling Twitter for a day or maybe more.
Yeah, definitely. But also,
you know, on my way home to my Airbnb, like I thought once again about the press conference, and I made a mistake, I believe, by not engaging in the subject, because that's an important topic to touch on. I should have asked a question, even though maybe there were no follow up after that, and I would have been the only one to ask about the subject. Still, I believe that our readers should be provided by worthy information and on subjects we want to cover on. So, yeah, I'm disappointed in that, but yeah.
At the same time, like I understand being reticent to engage in an act that might encourage death threats, which it did last time, you know? It's yeah, sort of a lesson in how we have many of these conversations, I guess, like we're having now, about why are the questions like what they are? Well, this is an experiment or a lesson in that. It's not necessarily the you know, a bunch of people gathering in a dark room and saying, how can we manipulate the media in such a way that it protects our power? But it's just these are sort of the natural occurrences and things that happen. And you've got, you know, random, you know, people who will do terrible things, like, you know, harass somebody online. And that does discourage things like asking a real question from happening again, of all things.
My last question, Lucas, before we let you go, were there any Scottish delicacies that you got to partake in Scotland?
So there was one semi-marathon that is held every year on Father's Day. So I was glad to be on the streets, even though it was raining, because we were in Scotland. No offense to Scots on the chat. But it was cool to see that. Other than that, and I will – that's the only thing I can say. Not the only thing, but for the first time in my life, I tried fish and chips. I don't like fish and chips. I'm sorry to every English person. I'm sorry to every Scottish person in the chat, but I don't understand the point. I just don't understand where we're going with that. With all due respect.
The preceding announcement was made by Lucas Sharpio. Myself and Brandon Thurston do not at all endorse his criticism to all of our British listeners out there. Fish and chips are a wonderful delicacy if you are so choosing it. But Lucas, we want to thank you very much for heading on over to Scotland, representing us very well over there. And I encourage people to check out the articles up on the Post Wrestling and WrestleNomics site. He did a pre-show story and one that just went up yesterday, kind of digesting all the key points, the arena gate record that the company set. And the countdown is on now till their next arena gate record is probably broken. Could be... maybe Toronto will be in striking distance. I haven't been looking at the pricing of these tickets, but we thank you very much, Lucas, for joining us, and we'll definitely have you on again in the near future.
Thank you very much, John and Brandon, and sorry about my wiki English today. Sometimes my voice gets a little bit messy. Sorry to have a better English accent today.
We understood you well. Thanks, Lucas.
Thanks a lot, Lucas. All right, everyone. Lucas Sharpio joining us, who was there live on behalf of WrestleNomics and Post Wrestling this past Saturday in Glasgow, Scotland. And so Clash at the Castle, the latest, the number that we got, and I don't know how much you were paying attention to this on the broadcast, Brandon, but Michael Cole was going through like waves of the attendance. I mean, it was up and down throughout the night. We started at 11,000 and change. It then became over 14,000, multiple in, references to over 14,000.
Maybe he's doing a live turnstile count. Maybe he had the scan. Maybe he had the TM app on his phone.
And then the turnstile turned on Michael Cole, because by the main event, we were back down to that 11,000 number. So it was all over the, when they first announced the 11,000 number, I mean, it was like 200 off of the WrestleTix number. I was like, wow, this is like the closest we've ever gotten. And then, 3,000 people were found.
Yeah. I'm guessing he's in a NBA sized arena, and he thinks the capacity of such a building is probably generally 14,000, and that seems reasonable. But you could see, did this have a big entranceway? I forget. Or was this the more consolidated entranceway?
This was a more, scaled down version, as they did for SmackDown as well.
But maybe it's just a slightly smaller building than, you know, a typical US NBA size arena. It's something to notice that they've been maybe more accurate with these announced attendances lately, although we did have I don't know what to make of the discrepancy that we've got from the WrestleTix estimate of WrestleMania of about 70,000 each night. And I've got receipts from the Athletic Commission saying 56,000 paid, with both nights basically being sellouts. And that's a total of tickets distributed. And I don't believe the WrestleTix nor what the commission gave me includes any suites. So we don't have to worry about that issue in this particular comparison. So I don't know what to make of that. But it does seem like maybe they are being more honest with the announced attendances.
Well, we know the man here on the show that is going to keep them honest.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, clickgranger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
WWE also making an announcement in concert with Pro Wrestling Noah this past weekend. AJ Styles is being sent over on July 13th for its pay-per-view that's going to be happening at Budokan Hall. He'll be taking on Naomichi Marufuji, or as AJ Styles announced it, he's challenging Marufuji to face him at the Budokan on July 13th. Now, what's interesting about this date is this is also the same day as Marigold's pay-per-view, where they're sending Io Sky to face Utami Hayashishita. I don't know if the times actually overlap with one another, but regardless, these are two pay-per-view events happening in the same day.
Where is the Marigold? Is it Tokyo also?
It's at, I think it's at like Sumo Hall. It's like a big building. Yeah.
Budokan and Sumo Hall in the same night?
I need to double check this, but so it's July 13th that Io Sky and AJ Styles will be wrestling for these two promotions. And
it is a real Ryogokukikan. Yeah. Yes.
So Marigold is really shooting for the moon with that particular one. As is Noah running Budokan here. So anyway, it's more of these kind of loose borders that WWE is flexing, and comes a day after Joe Hendry and Frankie Kazarian were on NXT on Tuesday night representing TNA in the 25-man Battle Royal.
Yes. And there was a report from, I believe, Lucha Libre Online reporting that WWE is seeking a partner from Mexico. Whether that's, who knows if that's CMLL or AAA, AEW works with both of them. But it's, you know, I believe, and I've been told, you know, to this effect, that at least part of what's motivating this cooperation with other wrestling companies is mitigating the risk of antitrust, which I think we're going to speak about more in a little while.
We'll be getting to that. It's not maybe this is something UFC will incorporate in the future.
they could do interpromotional cards with belts, or I mean, why not? Wouldn't that be a drawing card? But I think this is something that does. Obviously, there are other motivating factors here, and I'm sure, you know, Shawn Michaels is excited to have Jordan Grace and things like that, as he says. But it's also, if anybody tries to sue them for antitrust in the future, you do at least have this, whoa, look, we cooperate with TNA. We cooperate around the world, in fact, with Noah, with Marigold. Maybe we'll get a Lucha Libre partner here pretty soon. So it does help them make this argument that they're not at all anti-competitive. They're, if anything, they support and cooperate and work with their competitors.
Now, if we're talking about a Mexican partner, a Marigold, a Noah, a TNA, they're all in kind of different positions. But if you were running any of these companies, how would you be approaching these deals with WWE? Would you be going into it with caution? Is there any risk for some of these companies to have an association with WWE? Or is this just simply there's no harm in having some kind of working relationship with the industry leader, even though in, you know, that obviously WWE is not doing this for simply altruistic reasons.
I suppose for the decision makers involved, let's say Rossi Ogawa, even if there is some genuine negative impact over the long term, if you're Rossi Ogawa, they're probably going to take care of you at least, right? If WWE is going to take over, you know, a portion of the Japanese wrestling industry, they're going to need Rossi Ogawa to help them do that, I suppose. And I suppose that's what makes this all, you know, this is what benefits the self-interest of the people involved, I guess. So as far as, is there a risk to the industry, to that regional industry of wrestling? Probably, in terms of making it more competitive, especially from an outside player who has relatively endless resources compared to the strength of the wrestling companies that are in Japan that don't benefit from the media revenues that the U.S. wrestling companies do. But to the particular actors involved, especially like Noah doesn't strike me as a company that's on fire right now financially, nor do really any of these companies, that there's definitely at least a short-term motivating factor to do so. And again, for the decision makers involved, you at least probably earn some goodwill with that big player, WTKO, that will cause them to want to take care of you and need you around in the future, even if it's not to the long-term benefit of these companies.
Yeah. And I mean, it goes as well. Like this came up in New Japan's recent press conference they did about, you know, the perception that they are sort of the B side in this relationship with AEW and defending that. And I think if you're New Japan, you weigh the perception issues that maybe they have when they're losing some of their biggest stars to AEW. But at the same time, like this is a working agreement that also provides benefits for New Japan. And I think it's other companies that, you know, we're seeing this environment where you have these two very strong players and you want to be attached to them in some form or fashion. And there is reciprocation in these relationships as opposed to just one-sided or rating talent as, you know, the MO of the larger scale company.
Is there an argument if you're WWE to go to New Japan and say, you know, you have people who do think that you are, you know, sort of the B player in this relationship with AEW. We can treat you much better. We won't, you know, take your talent from you. We can provide you with all these things that AEW can't. I wonder if there's an argument there.
What we have seen, I mean, just historically with New Japan, I mean, we saw great loyalty that New Japan displayed towards Ring of Honor, that has towards CMLL, that it just feels like that relationship they're going to, I think, be very loyal to AEW in this whole scenario. But I mean, it would not surprise me at all that WWE will eventually kick the tires with New Japan again and just have a conversation of sorts. Like there is
would
obviously
Noah be the number two company in Japan right now after New Japan. Is that the best one they can get?
I think you'd look at a Noah, Dragon Gate. Like those would be like Dragon Gate often gets slept on. It's like a very, you know, DDT's under that umbrella as well of cyber fight as well. Like that's like your next tier, but yeah, you would be like, those would be kind of the candidates. Mm-hmm. We're going to shift focus because you know what, we had sealed the documents that had read UFC settlement. We thought we'd never have to talk about this again. The UFC were popping champagne bottles for the past month. The stock was up. Everyone was celebrating except Judge Richard Boulware, who had a big, whoa, 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 what are we doing here moment. So here to explain all of this to us, what is going on with the UFC antitrust lawsuit, returning to Pollock and Thurston, he is Eric McGraken, our favorite combat sports regulatory lawyer. Hello, Eric. How are you?
Hey, John, Brandon. Thanks for having me on again.
So I would have loved to have seen a live camera on you last week when we got apparently Paul Gift was like the only reporter that was in this courtroom. I don't know if we would have even known what would have happened had he not been there. But your reaction, were you expecting that this was going to be largely a rubber stamp process, or were your eyebrows at least raised about the settlement terms and your reaction to what was kind of a left field move this past week?
Yeah, and you're right. Paul Gift does deserve all the credit because nobody was reporting on this. He was in the courtroom, I guess, live tweeting it. Mm-hmm. And I've been saying from the get-go that it's not a rubber stamp process. So I can't say I was totally surprised, but I was a little bit surprised. The hearing last week was for preliminary approval, so it wasn't even to finalize the deal. It was simply to say, okay, we're probably going to approve this. Let's find out how to tell all the fighters about it so they could participate in the final hearing to get this over the finish line. And even at that preliminary stage, the judge said, pump the brakes on this. I've got some serious concerns. So, you know, it's a pretty major development, but the court has a duty to make sure class action settlements are fair to the class members. And if you read the certification decision, it's very clear we're dealing with a judge that thinks the fighters have an incredibly strong case here. And basically, you know, and this is all coming from Paul's tweets, but basically raised some real concerns about how little money the fighters are getting, about how much they're compromising to get this deal done. So this is, yeah, you know, this story's not done and it's worth keeping an eye on.
And so I'm looking at the docket, and there's at least two entries in the docket here that are they seem to be sealed. But this is what we're talking about, what happened on the 13th, and then there's a transcript on the 17th that this was something that only people in the courtroom knew. And why are there not filings now that we can look at publicly to look at for ourselves?
You know, there are some public filings. If you go to I think the URL is ufcfighterclassaction.com. That's the main site that is, I think it's run by the fighters bringing it, but basically they've got notice for all the fighters, and there's a lot of important documents published there. And so, you know, a lot of the exhibits, a lot of the filings with the court. Yeah, so if you click on important documents at the top there in the middle.
I'm going to do a walkthrough right
now.
And
then you can scroll down and see a lot of the and if you just scroll down, things like the declaration of these various parties, the settlement agreement and its exhibits, all of this has been filed with the court. And so the public do have access to some of these documents. But you know, bottom line is the court raised concern about how little money the fighters are getting. The judge had more questions about it, wanted more information, and basically pushed back the hearing until sometime next week. And then we got to see if the judge even gives preliminary approval. If the judge gives preliminary approval, it doesn't mean that the judge is going to give final approval down the road. So it's, you know, it's still far from certain about whether this thing is going to settle, whether the judge tells them to go back to the negotiating table, or whether it ends up in court. There's still some chance this does end up in trial.
And we do have, this encompasses both antitrust cases. We have the Kung Lee led case that covers fighters from December of 2010 till the end of June 2017, and then the Cajun Johnson case that takes place after June 30th, 2017. This pool of money that was $335 million. How different are the circumstances between the two classes of fighters? Because my understanding is those in the Cajun Johnson case, there's a lot of fighters that sign this provision. And does that somewhat present a ceiling of how much they're entitled to as opposed to the other class of fighters?
Yeah, so in the Johnson class, a whole bunch of the fighters, not all of them, but a whole bunch of the fighters signed, well, you know, call it the modern UFC contract, which has an arbitration clause saying you can't go to court, you have to arbitrate if you have a problem with us. And number two, you cannot participate in a class action lawsuit against us. And that kind of a clause has been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. So there's some real risk to a lot of the fighters in the Johnson class that they have basically very little chance of success. And so the Johnson class is being treated differently in the settlement than the Lee class. The lion's share of the money is being allocated to the Lee class. I think 75% is going to the Lee fighters, 25% to the Johnson fighters. And again, you sort of go back to the judge's comments. You know, the judge is saying he certified it on the basis that the damages for the fighters are anywhere between $800 million and $1.6 billion just for the Lee class alone, not even talking about the Johnson class. And if the fighters get those awards, the number then gets tripled because of how U.S. antitrust law works. So you could be talking about $4.8 billion. And so the judge is basically saying you're taking $335 million when you could be getting $4.8 billion, and that's not even factoring in how much more money the Johnson fighters could be getting. Why is this fair? I've got some questions about this. And the plaintiff's lawyers are going to have to do an interesting sort of a thing. They have to show up there, and after all these years of telling the judge about how strong the case is, have to explain why this level of compromise is fair. So it's sort of a balancing act that the plaintiff's lawyers have to do at these upcoming hearings.
And could you have maybe like dissenting views of those that are in the Kung Lee case? They might be looking on paper and like, yeah, we don't want to risk this. This is like a good amount of money for us. Whereas in the Cajun Johnson case, I'm sure you had fighters that maybe they're willing to like push this forward because they're looking at a lot less of the payout than the other classes.
Hey, John, I've got a terrible connection. Could you just quickly repeat that question?
I was just stating that you might have competing views of those that are entitled to more money in the Kung Lee case as opposed to the Cajun Johnson case and may have differing views of how they want to proceed here, of taking the guaranteed money versus pushing this forward and maybe taking this to trial.
Yeah, and there's hundreds and hundreds. I think something like 1,800 fighters are in these classes altogether. And obviously not everybody's going to be happy with the result. And so just the order of operations, this is a preliminary settlement approval. If the judge grants it, he then sets a final settlement approval hearing date. All of the fighters are given notice of that date and they're all told how they could object. So if some fighters think they shouldn't be approved and they've got some concerns they want to raise to the court, they've got a chance to tell that to the court and the judge has to weigh all of that evidence before giving the final seal of approval to this or before deciding not to approve this.
And in terms of the plaintiffs now, the judge is basically questioning or maybe questioning that the settlement is not good enough. So why would the plaintiff's side accept what may be a lower deal than they could have? And certainly the TKO stock acted as if this was a great result when this was announced and the stock shot way up. So like, why would the plaintiff settle for what seems like such a low deal? Is it just the risk of going to trial and then getting nothing?
Yeah, that risk is always there, right? Like these trials are all nothing or something in between. It's just so hard to predict what's going to happen. So it's easy to look at the high number of $4.8 billion, wonderful result, but dismissal is always possible. You walk away with nothing after a decade of hard-fought litigation. And I can't speak to all of the factors that the fighters and their lawyers are grappling with when deciding that this was a good deal and this deal was better than going to court. But if I had to guess, I imagine the fighters and their lawyers have jury consultants. I imagine they ran versions of this trial in front of mock juries. And I also imagine they got feedback that scared them a little bit, that made it seem that Joe Average off the streets of Las Vegas sitting in a courtroom listening to fighters asking for billions of dollars, that message doesn't resonate with everybody. And it doesn't come down to understanding the legal nuances. It's just you lock a bunch of jurors in the room and who knows who's going to be motivated by what. My guess, because you don't run a billion-dollar antitrust case without consulting with these jury focus groups, my guess is they got some feedback that this trial does have some real risks to it. And they pushed the UFC as far as they could. And this is the number they had on the table. And they made the calculated decision that the sure thing is probably better than rolling the dice at trial. But again, now they're facing a judge who's of the view that, I don't want to call it a slam dunk, but if you read the certification decision, it's like a complete blowout for the fighters. The judge basically said, yep, you're right. The UFC done you dirty. They've grown the stranglehold on the sport. They did it by having dirty contracts. They did it by exploiting those dirty contracts. And you guys have been ripped off to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more than $1 billion. And their stranglehold continues. So you got a judge who's thinking, if the UFC gets let off the hook for $335 million and all the current fighters have clauses in their contract saying they can't even sue the UFC and they can't even participate in antitrust lawsuit, the current state of affairs is just going to continue indefinitely. And part of antitrust litigation is to undo these kinds of strangleholds. So you've got a judge who's clearly grappling with this stuff. So it, you know, this is, you know, again, just really worth keeping an eye on what happens next week.
And the finder of fact, if that's the right term, would have to be a jury in this case and not a judge.
Yeah. If the trial proceeds, it goes in front of a jury. So they're going to, you know, they'd be the ones that make the call about whether there actually was an antitrust violation. And the jury would also make the call about how much money the fighters are entitled to, if anything.
So just to summarize, there will be a hearing next week. And what is the purpose of next week's hearing? What is that going to accomplish? Will Judge Boulware make any sizable decision in this hearing? Or what could we expect to be on the agenda?
Yeah, so things could always be adjourned, but assuming it doesn't get adjourned again, it's a preliminary approval of the proposed settlement. And so what the judge has to do is simply find that it is likely that he'll approve it at the final hearing sometime in the future, and that it's sufficient at least to pull the trigger on telling these 1,900 fighters about the settlement and telling them how they could either opt out of it or how they could object to it or how they could participate in this last stage of this very drawn out lawsuit. So that's next week's hearing. And assuming the preliminary approval is granted, then the judge sets the final hearing. They notify all these fighters and then they have a hearing about, you know, lawyer fees and all sorts of other stuff before it's completely finished. So it might be getting to the end or it might be just rebounding back to the negotiating table.
Well, Eric, we thank you very much for this update. I encourage everyone to check out his work, combatsportslaw.com. You can also follow him on X at Eric McGraken, E-R-I-K-M-A-G-R-A-K-E-N. Also on TikTok as well. So if you want to distill this information, TikTok is the avenue to go in. But thank you so much, Eric, for joining us and keeping us updated on what's a very important story that continues.
Thank you, Eric.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
All right. Eric McGraken, everybody. So antitrust, it's still out there, Brandon. And I mean, if you are the plaintiff's lawyers and you're risking going to trial, all you need is one jury member that's attended a slap fight event and you're screwed. Like that could be that's what you're resting your faith in here.
Power slap. You have a big power slap. And as we know, power slap is the most popular sport in the world right now.
It's if you take every sport, every entertainment, anything you've ever attended live, multiply it by five, that's Power Slap's popularity.
Ten times bigger than the NFL, right? The stock is not responding to this. When did this news come out?
This was Friday. And again, like Paul Gift, had he not been in this courtroom, I do not know if this information would have even like made its way out there. I would not doubt that plenty of the people that were celebrating and the stock soaring, I shouldn't say soaring, but it certainly responded positively when the settlement news came, might not even be aware that the judge kind of, you know, hit the brakes a bit on just rubber stamping this on Friday. But it's not like this has been a giant story since Friday, but not to say that this is going to be ultimately a complete reversal, but it's at least a pause on what was thought to be a completed settlement case between the UFC and these plaintiffs, and with the essential guarantee that no class of fighters are going to be able to do this again, given the contract provisions that they have. Like this was paying this lump sum and making this antitrust problem go away, at least in terms of a class of fighters being able to raise a case again in the future.
Yeah. Like I said, it's kind of surprising that there aren't any lasting changes to policy or to contracts going forward. It's just hundreds of millions of dollars and it goes away.
So I'm sure Mark Shapiro will have an update for us maybe on the next earnings call to give us his thoughts on antitrust practices. Yes. Let's talk about
if they want to go to trial, we're ready to do it.
It's a great question, and one that, listen, I love the PFL. I love the PFL. We have lots of competition. This is really a silly case. SmackDown on Friday night, it was their lowest number of the year, 1,959,000 viewers and a 0.52 in the demo, airing on a slight tape delay from Scotland. But this was their lowest since a best of show last December. And if you're looking in overall viewership for a first run episode on Fox, you have to go all the way back to August of 2022 for a number that was lower than this one. I would imagine this is a blip that is going to be corrected this week, as they are going up against the Stanley Cup Finals on Friday night, but they have CM Punk on the show. And in theory, you would think that is going to present a bit of the Chicago bump for SmackDown.
Yeah, this was against the NBA Finals. Did you mention that?
Oh, that's a good point. Yes. There were those.
Although Raw, I don't know if we're going to get to it, but Raw bought it just fine against the Finals. So make of that what you will.
Rampage doing 334,000 viewers and a 0.12 in the demo, up from what's typical for Rampage. But I mean, it's a show that is sort of in its usual state.
The highest since March for Rampage, which has been huge. It's been mostly in preemptions here since March, right? Like since March, they've had 1, 2, 3. This was the fourth show not in preemption.
Giant. Collision. It was the 1 year anniversary of Collision on Saturday night, and you say anniversary, it brings everyone out. 431,000 viewers and a 0.13 in the demo. This was up 11% in viewership from the week prior. Like a good number by Collision standards. It was a several week high for
this was our first year over year, because it was the 1 year anniversary. It was the first year over year comparison.
That's what Brandon was celebrating.
It was down 45% from the debut episode.
Man, 45% fill there. That's the difference. And then Monday's Raw, as Brandon mentioned, against the NBA Finals, where the Celtics defeated the Dallas Mavericks, 1,747,000 viewers, up 9% this week, while the demo, a 0.55, which was up 10%, their highest in since April 15th, I believe. Yes. Adults or P2 plus. So
why was it so high against pretty strong competition? The end of the NBA Finals.
Which did over 12 million viewers. Huge number for what has been overall a very underperforming NBA Finals on ABC.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about this renewal with the NBA and ESPN and TNT. You can see they might just cancel it.
I hope that these networks don't have a Jamie Kellner that's just looking for a brand new theme for their particular networks. Basketball gone. No, Raw performed very well here against the NBA Finals. You would have to look at this as, you know, some positive buzz coming off of Clash at the Castle for some kind of follow-up. I was surprised by this number. It's not as though they were advertising anything in advance of any significance for this show, but it performed very well, as it did in Canada as well, where they've been hurt very much, more so by the Stanley Cup Finals, but didn't have to deal with that on basketball. Not as big here in Canada, so they did.
I don't have quarter hours yet for Raw, but by far the most watched clip of this show from YouTube is Uncle Howdy returns with Sinister Friends, which,
you know what, that is the part that was promoted all week with the countdown, and you have to attribute some of that. Like, we did see when Bray Wyatt came back that that did spike interest for the lead up to the reveal, and yeah, you would certainly have to look at that as the focal point of Raw going into Monday's show.
Now, we do know from Programming Insider that the third hour was the least watched, but I don't think that is enough to rule out that there was a lot of motivation for people to tune in because of the are they being called the Wyatt Six?
The Wyatt Six, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
S-I-C-K-S.
Yeah.
Which also, Brandon, part of the Six today. He's a little under the weather, but he's powering through today. Like he's Damian Priest.
Yeah. Can everybody tell? Like, how?
No, you
said
you sound very good. You cover it better than I did the other night.
Better than I sounded this morning. I think that wasn't this game kind of a blowout. I had it on game five. Like, so it was not a particularly close game. But yeah, it's maybe it's the Wyatt Six, and they've passed 2 million views on YouTube with that clip now, which is really high relative to what's been happening usually.
All right. Well, there is your ratings information. You can keep it locked to WrestleNomics because the NXT number will be dropping soon. What is the impact of open lockers appearing in the 25-man battle royal?
Many locker rooms. How many locker rooms were there that were involved?
Well, if you count the main roster, I guess we had main roster talent, we had TNA talent, and that was about it.
Three.
Yeah. So multiple locker rooms. And Shawn Michaels believes in Joe Hendry. That was the big takeaway from Joe Hendry's appearance on the show. Also was very over to that crowd. That is going to wrap it up. So two guests today. We want to thank Lucas Sharpio and Eric McGraken for joining us. Also want to thank Brandon for powering through this episode as he will be back this Sunday for WrestleNomics Radio. We have got lots coming up. Wei and I will be up tonight with Rewind to Dynamite, so be sure to check that out as well. We are doing our Who Killed WCW series up at postwrestlingcafe.com. We're going to have Evan Husney on again next week, right before episode 4 airs. And we will probably, maybe even have a little, WCW sale talk bleed into Pollock and Thurston next week, because we're going to get Brad Siegel and Stu Snyder on camera next
guests?
Week. Not coming on to our show. Amazingly, LinkedIn, they're not getting back to me so quickly, but, we will see. Maybe we'll shoot our shot for, some of these, former WCW, WWF executives. We got to wait for them to be out of office for like 20 years. And I think I think we're on like a special list, among current executives. do not reply. But nonetheless, that's coming up next week, the sale of WCW. And you know what? I look forward in 30 years that we'll still be talking about the end of WCW.
If we're all alive in 30 years, it'll be 2054. That's like,
I can believe it.
That's past singularity. So I'm not going to speculate about that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks everyone for tuning in. We appreciate all of you joining us live. We're here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern time. Again, go check out our work, postwrestling.com, wrestlenomics.com, and we will speak with you next week right here on the internet.
Bro.